Wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Badminton Podcast, a community for badminton players, by badminton players, proudly brought to you by Velan. We talk all things badminton and aim to inspire you to be better in your game and in life by celebrating the people and stories of our global badminton community, whether they be past or present professional players, social players, officials or fans.
We're your hosts, Jeff and Henry, and we love badminton. From the bottom of our hearts, we'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has listened to, shared, and been part of the podcast. It wouldn't be possible without you all. If you do enjoy our episodes and can spare just a couple of dollars each month, you can really help keep the podcast going by supporting us on Patreon. Just visit www.patreon.com/thebadmintonpodcast. We'll leave the link in the description.
We are really excited for this one. Today, we're introducing you all to Benny Law, the founder of NextShark.com, a leading Asian American Pacific Islander media company covering news, business, politics, entertainment, and culture that reaches up to 20 million people per week across social platforms. NextShark has been cited by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Forbes, BBC, CNN, Fox, and more, and has led coverage of anti-Asian violence since the beginning of 2020. Now, previously, he was the founder of NewMediaRockstars.com, a leading media company covering digital entertainment that was acquired in 2013. And if all of that wasn't enough, in 2018, he was inducted into the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in media.
I'm a new dad, and you know, I have a 1 year and 8 month old at home. Success to me is really just hoping that I can do something that makes him proud of me, to be honest. I mean, just raising this kid right. And for me, like, why that's become kind of like a big priority for me is that I'm helping raise the next generation. And you know, for me and as citizens of this world, I think that the best thing that we could do for the next generation is to leave them better than we found them. Prepare them to make the world a better place. Of course, we need to make our own contributions to make a good world, but we also really need to teach the next generation the right things too. And I think that that's much more important than anything that you can do in this lifetime.
So, joining us from Japan, welcome onto the podcast, Benny.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here, guys.
It did take a while for us to get you on, Benny, but we're really excited to finally have you on and have the conversation. I have a feeling that this one's going to be a long one, which is exciting for us, but maybe not that exciting for you because it's probably going to be quite late after all of this, but I'm excited to have this chat.
I can talk about badminton all day, man. So, you know, I'm just as excited and I'm really looking forward to this.
Speaking of, let's start with your badminton story, shall we? When did you actually start playing badminton, Benny?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. So when I was in high school here in the States, I was a freshman and I actually had a crush on a girl who was an upperclassman at the time. And I chatted her up and we became friends and she invited me to, you know, badminton practice one day. And over time, I ended up, you know, falling in love with the sport. And I think I was pretty much like instantly hooked. I mean, I started off like pretty much bottom of the barrel. I mean, I was never really athletic growing up, I guess you could say. I couldn't even catch a ball back in the day. But with badminton, something just really drew me to it. And almost immediately, I was just trying to play like pretty much every day. I was still the weakest on the team. I think that I didn't even make it to like, I think I was like in the lower junior varsity at that time. But I loved the sport so much. Even after school practice, I would go to a local community college right after and I would play for like up to like 3 more hours. So imagine this. It's like practice starts at 3 o'clock. We end at 6. And then I would immediately like take the bus to a local university. And then I would play from like 7 to 10 o'clock from there. And so it would be like sometimes like 6 hours of badminton, 5 days a week. And overall, it's just really, really enjoyable.
That's actually a very interesting way that you got into the sport. We've had some people who have been in couples from badminton. So for example, Henry met his girlfriend through badminton and he's now fiance.
But I haven't heard of one like being a crush and joining because it was a crush. And it reminds me of some of the memes that you see around. And it's like when you play normally and then there's a video. And then when your crush is watching and it's like you jump smashing and moving really fast and going crazy. So I can imagine that that was probably you for 6 hours.
Yeah, pretty much. It's funny that you mentioned the crush too. It was kind of like I went in because I liked her, but then I ended up liking the sport more than her.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. And when you say you were playing like 3 hours, taking the bus, going another 3 hours, you love the sport because did you like it more for the physical, the mental thing, or did you like the community, the friendships more? Like it's probably all of them, but what really stood out for you as to why badminton was a sport you grew to love so quickly?
You know, I just loved like hitting the bird or the shuttlecock and I love the intensity of it. I like the speed of it. I like that there were so many elements to the game. You know, you had to be agile, a lot of speed, you had to have strength, you had to have flexibility. And not many sports really kind of, you know, drew me that deeply. I mean, if you look at, let's say, basketball, right, you kind of, physicality is such a big thing. Like you have to be like X amount of height in order to really play professionally, right? Or if you look at, let's say, you know, American football of some sort, you really have to have a certain body type for it. Even with like volleyball per se, you know, like you have to be a certain height in order to get there. Whereas when I was looking at badminton, I saw like such a diverse physical bodies, right? And it looked like just something that anybody could play. So that really drew me to it. And I just really loved every moment on the court. And so for me, it was really just kind of like the love of the game. And obviously being able to, you know, play with friends, you know, people you like, that's always a big positive.
Yeah, badminton is just one of those sports that caters to all types of people. Whenever you go into the stadium, it's not when you go into any kind of like truly physical sport, you tend to see, a uniform body type sort of forming, especially when you get to those really high levels. But generally speaking, when we see like social players, it's so varied and dynamic, and any player can be good. You can't really just judge them on their physical body type when you actually play against them as well, which is one of the really cool things about badminton that I love about the sport. So Benny, we talked briefly about you jumping into badminton as a sport because of this crush of yours, and you ultimately loved badminton more than this crush. But I'm sure everyone that was listening was wondering, how did the crush go? Like, how did you go?
It was kind of like a high school romance type of thing. I mean, we never really dated, but, you know, I was able to, in America, we have this sort of thing called homecoming. I don't know if you guys have that in Australia, but.
Is it like prom? Is prom homecoming? Is that the same thing?
Not necessarily. We have prom too, but homecoming is kind of like, I don't even know how to explain it. I mean, it's a casual sort of like, I think it's like sports related, and it also, it's kind of like a dance of some sort, and people, you know, do ask each other for as a date and everything, but it's not like a formal like prom where like you have to get dressed and everything. So it's pretty much casual. And so I managed to go out with an upperclassman as my homecoming date. And so as an underclassman, that was kind of a cool thing at that time, right? But you know, overall, like it was really just like a very innocent sort of crush type of thing. It wasn't like anything serious, never like blossomed into anything serious. And we just really just still remained friends over the years.
Awesome. That's good. So it all worked out for everyone. So Benny, when we were organizing this recording, this podcast episode, you were talking just briefly about your badminton achievements, and you were able to achieve some, I know that you started off as a beginner, you said that you weren't one of the stronger players, but you were able to achieve some really good things during your time as when you were training and you were competing. And you said that, we'll discuss basically what those things were, but you also talked about how that gave you the confidence to pursue the other things in your life as well. What were you able to do in badminton, and how did that kind of help you with the amazing things you've been able to do after those achievements?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a journey, I guess you could say. I mean, that question, there's a lot of layers to it, you know? And so my answer also have a lot of layers too. For me, I struggled a lot growing up. I struggled a lot in school. I didn't really know what I was good at. And for a long time, you know, I had confidence issues because, you know, number one, I wasn't good at school. Like I was always like barely passing. And up until high school, you know, during parent teacher conference and everything like that, it will be the same conversation where, hey, if Benny doesn't do better, he might get held back a grade of some sort, right? And so in academia, I was already struggling. And in sports, I didn't really, you know, I didn't have like the body, the sort of hand-eye coordination and everything. And, you know, for a long time, I was like, man, like, you know, what am I good at, right? And when I kind of fell in love with badminton, I really, really wanted to get better at it. And at the time, there weren't that many resources. This was kind of like the pre-YouTube era, right? And so nowadays, like, badminton tutorials are everywhere. But back then, I mean, there was a lack of coaches. There was a lack of high-level players, really. And so how I learned was I managed to obtain like a DVD of, I think it was like the 2003 World Champions or something like that. And I watched the crap out of that. I think I watched like, you know, probably hundreds of hours of that same like DVD, because it was really my only window to, you know, to seeing how professional sports was played. I wouldn't say I ever really had like a professional coach that kind of taught me point by point of how to, you know, this stroke or that stroke. I took a couple of lessons, but even then, I mean, there really wasn't like a formal program where it kind of like, okay, this is how you go from point A to point B. And so a lot of, you know, my badminton knowledge is really just watching good players play and trying to mimic them and everything like that. I mean, I would say it really wasn't until recently where I started seeing all this cool, you know, and high quality badminton online that I really started learning, okay, this is actually how you hit the bird. This is actually how you utilize the racket and everything, right? But I guess to answer your question, as I started getting better at badminton and, you know, making varsity, you know, my second year in college, getting the bronze medal for regional champions. I think for us, we have something called Central Coast Section. So it's kind of like our particular region. You know, I got the bronze medal my junior year. And then my senior year, I actually ended up winning the entire thing. And I was able to kind of compete in some national tournaments. And I think my highest ranking at the time was like 16th in US for under 19 boy singles. And just seeing these achievements, I mean, I think from an outside perspective, it's like, okay, well, it's a high school, like, you know, championship. It's not that big of a deal. But for me, like, even looking back from all the achievements that I have today, like in business, like you mentioned Forbes 30 under 30 or all these like different things, I don't think anything has that feeling of like, oh my God, I did it. I don't think that feeling nothing has been comparable to that feeling of winning that regional championship. And I still think about it to this day. It's weird. I still kind of get goosebumps thinking about it. And I think it was just because like that was the first time in my life where it's like, wow, like I could do it. I was the worst at something and I became like one of the best at something, right? And that's when I really kind of started believing in myself, where it's like, okay, if I can do this, that means that there's got to be other things that I could achieve too. Like, things are possible. It opened the doors for me, right? And I think that really was kind of like that catalyst to the mindset that I have today.
Yeah, it's such an incredible badminton journey that you've been on. And it's kind of instilled this level of confidence in you, Benny, to pursue all these other things that you've achieved. Yeah, just by, as you mentioned, they might not be the greatest achievements in the world, but they're very important life events for yourself. So one aspect of that is the confidence that you've had to pursue other things in life, whether that be NextShark or other business ventures. But what about the things that are a bit more specific? So in terms of the lessons that you've learned from badminton, I think one of the things that I can sort of draw from this conversation is that you kind of are a lifelong learner. It sounds like your badminton journey is continuing to grow as you're learning off of, well, maybe it's Instagram Reels, YouTube Shorts, or actual full YouTube videos. What are some of the lessons that, maybe not so much from a confidence perspective, but more specific in terms of that you've been able to apply to your personal or your business life as well?
Yeah, great question. I think that there's so many elements to this game, right, that you can really apply to life, right? Whether as a competitor, right? When you're dealing with a lot of challenges, whether it's a tough opponent of some sort, right? Learning to center yourself, learning to kind of like not letting your emotions affect you and everything, right? So you have those things where the mentality of keeping cool and staying in the zone and how that relates to how you run a business or, you know, how you do other things in your life. I think that's incredibly relevant, right? You also have kind of the motivating factor too, right? for example, one of my favorite players and who I kind of consider a mentor, Tony Gunawan. I'm sure you guys know, you know who he is. Two-time world champion, Olympic gold medalist, known as kind of like the Jordan of badminton doubles, if anything. And he always kind of told his students what his coach told him. And that was like, if better is possible, then good is not enough, right? And I think that that's something that I hold dear to my heart, even to this day, right? And for me, it's like when I'm doing something, right? Whether it's business or whether, you know, I have different businesses that I'm a part of. I'm in the media business, part of, I'm also kind of in the food business as well. I work with high-end chefs with the business I'm in. And when we're talking to, let's say, people that are really good at something, let's say a really good chef, right? We talk about this aspect of pursuing constant refinement and constantly figuring out ways of going to the top, but we don't have any idea what that top means, right? But we enjoy that process of constant refinement to see like how far can you stretch this, right? And in a sense, like that's so relatable to badminton, you know? And that is a notion that I instill in myself to this day. And by the way, you know, my badminton journey is really interesting. So after I won, you know, that high school regional champions, I was actually invited to train at a pretty high-end gym. At the time, we technically don't have a national team, but this was like kind of like a gym where all the national players trained at. And I was able to get invited and they were offering me, you know, being able to train with literally the top players in the nation. But ultimately, my family told me, kind of like discouraged me to not do it because, you know, number one, I had just gotten into college. Number two, like there's in the States, I don't know if it's the same in Australia. It's very, very hard to make a living off this game, right? There's not many resources and everything. And so it was very, very tough decision for me, but it was one of those things where, man, this is such an opportunity of a lifetime. But at the same time, I had to tell myself, I still got to make a living eventually, right? And it's just the right way to go. And so I actually stopped for like, I would say, I kind of stopped playing maybe around 2007. And I think I started again recreationally about 7 or 8 years later. But the moment that I stepped back on like 7 to 8 years later, I mean, it was just, you know, the love was still there, right? And I'm still a recreational player. I mean, I still play like regularly, maybe 2 to 3 times a week. And what I love about this game is kind of going back to the different elements is that no matter like how old you are, there's always like something to improve, you know? Of course, like when you reach a certain age to play at a high level, like at the world-class level, I mean, there's obviously a time when you kind of have to retire, right? But even after you retire, there's so many different angles that you can go about it, right? I remember talking to Peter Gade once, right? I remember asking him, I was like, hey, what do you think of people like Li Changwei? You know, this guy's been busting his ass, like training, putting his heart and soul, blood, sweat, tears into the game for a long time. And he was trying to pursue a world champion. He was trying to pursue an Olympic gold medal, right? And it was tough because he was in the same era as Lin Dan and, you know, all these incredible players. And it was almost like that gold was always like just a small margin away. Right. And I asked him like, you know, what do you think of that sort of journey? And, you know, what he says is that, of course, you want your hard training to be validated. Right. And of course, you know, he believes that if you train hard enough, you will get the results that you want. But sometimes like, whether you're a champion or not, there's so many, you know, elements to it. And that's the tough part, right? But you can't think that way. At the end of the day, I mean, this is kind of like a daily practice, right? It's something where it's that sort of like that pursuit, that self-discovery. It's not so much about like, you know, if we try to rank each other, there's always going to be a higher mountain, no matter what. You know, there's always going to be someone richer than you, more successful than you, right? But what's most important is your story, your journey, right? And at the end of the day, you know, whatever you're trying to pursue, whatever that finish line looks like, once you cross that finish line, you know, that moment of like, oh my God, I did it. It's actually lasts for a short period of time, right? I would say maybe 10, maybe 20% at most. The rest of the 80% is like reminiscing on like, oh my God, like that journey, you know, what was it like getting there? Or like, it was like, oh man, you know, that time I lost that embarrassing game, you know, to someone that I didn't lose, or man, that time when I got injured and it took me out for a couple months or what have you. I mean, you remember those things because like, that's really what brought you here in the first place, right? That sort of like notion is just something that I really, really, truly live with. I mean, I feel like badminton and my life is so like interconnected. And, you know, for a long time, it didn't really, I don't know, I was trying to dissuade myself from it. But for me, like looking back, I'm like, wow, so many things, that lessons and experiences that I learned really shaped, you know, who I am today and why I am who I am.
Yeah, that's awesome. And going back to what you were saying about just what can you do to be a little bit better? What's that 1%? Because like you said, that Chong Wei winning the gold is a 1% thing, right? It is that close. And sometimes it doesn't always happen that way. It doesn't always turn out the way that you want. But I guess you've always got to shoot as if it's, if you can, and it will happen. And then sometimes you won't get there all the way. If you look back at, say, your career, your business career, whether that be with Next Shark or with New Rockstars, et cetera, were there any periods of time where you were working that hard for that kind of that pinnacle, that goal, whatever that was, and you did think you did do that extra 1% and you did push for that, but then you didn't quite make it? What were those experiences like, and how were you able to like rebound from those? Like, because you said, like Peter Gator said, you work that hard and you want to have it pay off, but sometimes you work that hard and it doesn't pay off in the way that you want exactly. How have you experienced that in your life as well, in your professional life?
Yeah, I mean, so you're basically alluding to like kind of low points and everything, right? Like, how do you deal with those low points in your life and coming out of it, right? And so I would say, here's my philosophy on that. I think that we've all kind of seen that viral graph where it's like what success looks like. Like, we think that success is a linear line where, you know, it's just an upward trend, right? And that's not the case. Success just looks like this crazy squiggly line and everything. And you can go like up and you can go down, right? To answer your question, I mean, those moments in terms of like, you know, trying really hard and not getting what I want, I still feel that even to this day. Running a company and running a startup, it's kind of, you know, 1 month you could be like, oh my God, I'm on top of the world, I'm the shit. And then next 2 months, you're like, oh my God, I'm gonna go out of business. You know, what am I gonna do? Running a business, it's a huge emotional roller coaster. It's something where it's definitely not for the faint of heart, for sure, I guess you could say. You're gonna be pulled in so many different directions as you go. And how I kind of, I guess you can cope with this is that I try to remain positive. You know, at the end of the day, it's kind of like no pain, no gain. It's one of those things where you're not going to win if you don't play, right? And sometimes like you might have like a huge losing streak or whatever it is, but every loss, you actually gain something. People always think that, oh, like this is my down point. This is such a bad moment in my life. It's like, no, but this is actually an amazing moment in your life because like you're learning something. If you actually look back and you're like, okay, what can I learn from this? You know, because it's teaching you something, right? And ultimately, it's really those low points that you're going to remember, because that's really those moments when you truly, truly grow as a human being. High points, like those are easy, you know, like, oh yeah, you know, it's I did it. Great. You know, finally, you know, and I'm not trying to downplay success. I'm just saying that ultimately what matters is those low points and how you come out of it.
That actually reminds me of our conversation, as you're mentioning, with the Jordan of badminton doubles, Tony Gunawan. He said in our podcast episode, you either win or you learn. And that's exactly the, I guess, what I would like to emphasize as part of what you just mentioned, Benny, because that's the thing. Like, regardless of whether it's a win or a loss, we often revert back to baseline and then see what's next. So it's very interesting to hear your take on that. But I guess speaking of the highs and the lows, we talked a bit about your badminton so far. Perhaps we should, I guess, switch gears a little bit and talk about your business journey. Obviously, it sounds like you've started quite early in terms of the way that you've dealt with entrepreneurship. I feel like you started quite early, but it would be really good to hear, I guess, from you, your perspective on when your actual, your tinkering mindset, your creative flair started.
You know, first of all, I think I only became an entrepreneur, my own boss, because I just thought that I wasn't good at anything else. You know, when I first got into university, I didn't want to be a financial burden to my parents. So immediately I kind of went to work, right? And also the other reason why I immediately went to work too was because I had every intention of graduating college, and I did graduate college. I passed, and I'm grateful for my degree and everything. But for the most part, I knew that I was not going to be a top student. And so I thought to myself, okay, in 4 years, I'll probably pass, but how am I going to compete with everybody else? Like all the people that are getting better grades than me and everything. I got to figure out how to play this game a little bit differently. You know, I have to adjust because if I play the same game as everybody else, I'm not going to, you know, this is not going to work. I got to play to my strengths, right? So I thought, okay, if I can't get good grades and win academically, I can at least get as many skills as possible, right? And so I went to work and I was a workaholic, man. I mean, I think I was, at one point I was working 4 jobs at once. You know, I can still count them. I was driving this big anteater truck. So Anteater was, I went to UC Irvine. So Anteater is our mascot, right? And so, you know, I would drive this like big, you know, truck all over campus and just hand delivering computers to faculty members and staff. And, you know, I remember it was hard, man. It was like, I would have to carry big like iMacs and stuff like that up like, you know, 3-4 flights of stairs to deliver them to teachers and everything. My second job, I was a sales guy at the computer store on campus. My third one was I was a student marketing rep for Dell Computers at the time. So essentially my job was to market Dell Computers to students by hosting events on campus and just finding different ways to reach out to students. I was also a campus note taker for people with disabilities. Like, you know, maybe they had a disability where they couldn't take proper notes on campus. And so, you know, this was my way of making money while also essentially I was getting paid to go to class and take good notes. And I felt that was just a great way, you know, for gain. And my fourth job, I was also working as a marketing intern for a test prep company. And, you know, I was doing all this while I was still like going to school and everything. My second year, I had met an upperclassman that was making good money playing online poker. I think he was making like up to like 5 figures a month just doing this. And so, you know, he kind of became my mentor and I started playing online poker. I'll be honest, I wouldn't say I was insanely successful at it, but let's just say like I made enough off of poker to buy my first car. So, you know, there was mild success, but not enough to be like, oh, this is life changing and, you know, I'm going to be super wealthy and what have you. But through poker, I met a lot of like great businessmen and I learned a lot from them. And this was kind of like that window to, okay, like this is what it means to have financial freedom. And for a long time, I thought that, okay, so, you know, I just need to make a lot of money and just focus on that and I'll be good, right? And that kind of, you know, seeing that lifestyle of like a poker player and seeing that they, you know, they could work on their own schedule and that idea of like, wow, like while other people have to work a 9-to-5 job, like somebody could go out to like Hawaii and just like on a work night and on a work day and everything and just like relax. Like that was really interesting to me, I guess you could say. And I would say my third and fourth year, I kind of like transitioned out of poker and I had met a 16-year-old kid that was making up to 5 figures a day doing internet marketing. And this was like, and I was like, wow, this is crazy, a 16-year-old kid. And, you know, so at the time I learned a lot of internet marketing, affiliate marketing skills from him. I learned about like SEO and viral marketing before, like those terms were even coined at the time. So, you know, my journey really was that I was very lucky in a sense where I met a lot of great people that, you know, seemingly they kind of had it together and obviously they were much more successful than me. And I think that through learning from these people, I think that really kind of helped shape my sort of entrepreneur mindset, I guess you could say. But I will preface this also by saying that despite having like, I guess, you know, people that I learned from and mentors and everything, I can't stress this enough. I mean, the biggest lessons that I learned was really just trying and failing and doing it again and continuing to, you know, fail and, you know, start the process over again. That was really what I learned the most. And the reality is, I mean, just like badminton, just like everything else, everybody's journey is different. And I think that for me, I'm still learning to this day. I think I'm forever a badminton student for life and I am forever a student for life in general.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's really inspiring to hear, I guess, whenever you hear about, say, successful entrepreneurs or people who've done really well in business and you go back to the roots of when it started, so hearing the reason why it started is always really interesting for me. So those 4 jobs and you did it so that your parents didn't have to support you through college and you could support yourself, et cetera. And then kind of one thing led to another. And then, yeah, I think the best thing that people like yourself or resourceful people like yourself do is they kind of make, it's very cliche to say they make lemonade when they've got lemons, right? So when you were helping the disability, the people with disabilities who couldn't write their own notes, for example, like that was also in helping you as well. So it's kind of like finding those win-wins and using your skills to, yes, make the money, but and also develop yourself as a person, as a student, and as an entrepreneur yourself. But in terms of the success that you've have had, I know that you said that you've failed many times, you've rebuilt and you've got up back on the horse to start again. So from my understanding, you started with New Rockstars as one of the projects that went really well. And we've noticed that a lot of the things you've been doing, so that we'll go on to, which is like NextShark, et cetera, are very much related to media. But I'd love to hear what was the inspiration behind New Rockstars. And obviously that's kind of bloomed into other projects you've worked through.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's interesting. I don't have a plan for anything ever. I mean, I'm not a good planner. I'm a good doer. Like if I have an idea, if all three of us were like, okay, you know, we decide to build a house, like you might go, okay, cool. All right, you write the blueprint. Okay, you plan this, like this, you know, measure, whatever. I'll be laying down bricks already. You know what I mean? So it's like that. I'm just the type of guy.
Now, just a quick word from our sponsors.
The Badminton Podcast is brought to you by Volant. Volant was first born out of our frustration with the confusing, bright, and unsightly clothes and equipment that we saw in the badminton world. But now, it's so much more than that. Our mission is to accelerate the growth of badminton by providing players with products that enhance their love for the sport. All in all, it's high-quality gear that makes you look and feel great on and off the court. So make sure you check us out at volantbadminton.com and follow us on our socials at volantbadminton.
As not a good planner, it's kind of like you prefer to, like how I look at it is moving is better than not moving. And I would rather like keep the car moving and fix it on the way there as opposed to just like spend all this time like fixing the car and everything, right? I think that for me, how I got into media, man, that's also a really good question. I mean, I've done interviews already and I've done like different sorts of, you know, ventures and stuff. And every time, like, you know, I'm referred to as like a journalist, you know, by the media and everything, I'm okay with that, you know, with that title, but it's just interesting because looking back, I never thought I would ever be referred to as that, like a media person or a writer or a journalist, because I always struggled in school. I mean, even back in college, I mean, I think I was testing at like a freshman in high school reading level still at that, or writing level at that time. And so I think how I got into media was really my curiosity of people. I mean, I really liked meeting people, and this all goes hand in hand with, let's say, you know, business and even badminton per se, right? I mean, let's go back to badminton for a little bit and that journey, right? How did I get better? I really just wanted to meet as many good players as possible. I wanted to hang out with as many like great players as possible. I even, back when in 2005, when they held the World Championships, that was the one where Tony Gunnar won and Howard Bach, you know, won that year. I volunteered as a liaison officer at that time. And, you know, meaning that I was just basically there to volunteer to help players as much as possible. And at the time I was assigned to Team Malaysia and Estonia and everything. And I was like, oh my God, this is such an amazing opportunity. I'm going to see like, you know, some of the best players in the world. I had no idea who the best players were aside from like whatever I saw in that DVD. And at that point, it was like, oh, it was Wang Chun-Han. It was Xiaoxuan Zhe. It was, you know, Sigurd Butiardo, Chandra, just anybody that was there. That's all I knew. I didn't know like who anybody was. And so when I was signed to Malaysia, I was like, oh, I only know Wang Chun-Han here and everything. And then, when I was talking to the coaches, I think I remember, you know, meeting the coaches for the first time. And I think I had to ask everybody five times what their name were. You know, Chesun Keat had to keep like repeating his name to me. Yap Kim Hawk also had to keep repeating his name to me because I kept like forgetting and everything. And they assigned me actually to Lee Chong Wei to help him out at the time. And even with Lee Chong Wei, I kept forgetting his name at that time. I had such horrible memory, you know, back then. But, you know, even through that tournament, I was like networking like crazy. I mean, I got to be good friends with Lee Chong Wei. You know, I hung out with Lin Dan like pretty much like almost half a day. And this was like before he was like who he was today. When I saw Tofik, I mean, and also I was not shy reaching out to people. I was like, dude, I only get like this opportunity once. I don't care if I embarrass myself. Any player that I think I recognize, I'm going to try to, you know, go and talk to them, right? And I was able to make friends with a lot of these people, some of whom that I still, you know to this day. And that was just me just being bold and everything. And this heavily relates over to my business life too, because, you know, when I wanted to get good at business and everything, I was like, okay, I just got to find like people who are more successful than me and just try to learn and meet them and just have a conversation with them. I mean, I don't care if I bomb. I don't care if I get rejected. And naturally, because over time, when I became a natural networker, I started just meeting a lot of incredible people with just great, great stories. And I really loved the idea of kind of telling these people stories. I mean, I had a blog at the time, and anytime I was able to meet someone interesting, you know, I would just do like an informal interview, and then I would kind of take mental notes on my blog, right? Now, kind of going back to New Media Rockstars, right? That kind of stemmed from me having a site for a blog for Asian Americans. So right after I graduated college, me and two other classmates started kind of like a community blog that focused on telling Asian American stories. And naturally, at the time, the top 10 YouTubers, a lot of them were Asian American. So I don't know if you guys remember Ryan Higa, you know, Kev Jumba, all these people. And so I was able to meet a lot of these, you know, different people, you know, just through networking with the right people and working in the right environments and everything. And the idea of New Media Rockstars really stemmed from me looking at all these YouTubers that I was meeting. And I was like, wow, these guys have really massive followings. And these guys are essentially celebrities, but mainstream media is not treating these people as such, right? And so I was like, why don't I start a site that really treats these guys like celebrities, you know, really tells their stories and offer a window into their lives. And that's how New Media Rockstars was born. And as you can see now with NextShark, everything kind of comes full circle, right? I mean, it was Asian American blog that I got into it, then New Rockstars, sold it in 2013. Then I started NextShark. NextShark started off as a site for on business and success for young people, not an Asian American site. And so the name Shark actually comes from my experience as a poker player, Poker Shark. And the next signifies next generation. Did that for 2 years in. And then we noticed that, I think 2016, we noticed that a lot of our Asian centric content was doing well. And we started slowly pivoting from there. And now coming back full circle, now back to focusing on Asian American content, which is, you know, also one of my passions.
It's a really big journey, Benny. I'm not sure what part to focus on other than if you were to look back at that journey now with the, I guess, New Media Rockstars and that transition to NextShark, what are some of the key learnings that you took from that, that you were able to just go bam, bam, bam in NextShark? You know, I like how you, you know, the way that you tackle things is that, you just jump off a cliff and build the plane while you're falling down, right? So you've probably, as part of your journey with New Media Rockstars, you've learned all these things through the ups and downs that we talked about earlier. Were there like a few key things where you just went into NextShark and you're like, okay, this is how I do it because this worked last time?
Ooh, that's a good question too. It's interesting because you would hope that it's a linear thing where it's like, I learned this and I can apply to these sort of things. What I've learned, and especially in this current world where a lot of things are online, things are constantly changing and they're changing at a really, really, really fast pace. And so a lot of the things, what I found was actually the opposite. I found that a lot of the things that I learned that work with New Media Rockstars didn't necessarily work with building NextShark. And the reason being was not so much that I didn't learn the right things. It was just that society changes, things change. I mean, think of it this way. When I was in high school, the biggest social media platform was like MySpace or Friendster or whatever it is, right? Then Facebook came about and that was, and they were really, you know, the stars the room for like a long time. Now, then it was kind of like Instagram. And then now like everybody's on TikTok. And the interesting thing is that while we categorize everything here, all these different platforms as like social media platforms, they do very, very, very different things, right? And so if I was a Facebook expert, like let's say now or 10 years ago, I'm not going to know anything about, you know, how that applies to TikTok, right? And so if there was any major lesson that I learned was that I have to embrace change and I need to be able to understand that my environment is going to change. It's always going to constantly change, right? And if I don't embrace that change, I'm going to be left behind very, very quickly. And so, and that's kind of my philosophy to not only myself, but that's also what I tell like a lot of my team members too, like whom I work with, is that we could change at a drop of a hat. And that's because it's necessary, because we're trying to do something really, really difficult. And that's to build a sustainable media business. I mean, or any business is very, very tough, right? And in order for us to really sort of to continuing on this journey is that we need to really learn to adapt and really embrace change and also understand that no matter how successful we get or no matter how knowledgeable we get, we still have no idea of most things in the world. And so, you know, for me, like when I say I'm a student for life, it's, you know, it's not just about learning from people that are higher up from me or whatever it is. I learn a lot from, you know, people younger than me too, you know? And I think that it's that sort of openness from both sides, from like, you know, any side really, that has really kind of helped not only center myself, but really kind of figure out how to best plan my next moves.
Yeah, that's really interesting and really cool. Going back to when you said that you were with New Media Rockstars when you were talking about YouTubers, it just brought me back to my uni days when I used to watch Nigga Higa or Ryan Higa so much, and like Kev Jumba and Wong Fu, all the Wong Fu stuff as well. So that's really cool in terms of that. But it's really interesting because I guess it's so normal for someone to say, in business anyway, you hear it so much. It's like the only constant is change, and everyone's like change. And it's so repeated that it kind of, to me, it's diluted the meaning. It's like, you have to be adaptable. Yeah, I know I need to be adaptable, but what does that actually mean? And I guess you've kind of broken it down where it's learning from everyone. It's taking those failures. And a lot of the time when you get stuck in the kind of the older ways to do things. So just as a background for you, Benny, I work with quite a lot of dentists, who own dental practices. And you've got kind of that older generation who think that the old school way, they're kind of like stuck in that way. And they're like, I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be doing that. That's not what dentistry is about. But dentistry's changed so much since they were kind of in their prime and they're kind of retired or retiring. So that's really interesting to hear. But when you talk about the change and the fluidity of what you're doing in able to adapt, like, how do you usually discern what is a change you would want to make versus something that is kind of fleeting and you're not sure, like it could just be a thought that came across your mind or someone said something and it doesn't actually mean anything? Like, because I guess every change that you're trying to implement, you're not going to know if it's going to work or not. So how do you choose, okay, we're going to go for this change or we're going to really try this compared to, okay, what do you say no to? Because I feel that one of the dangers is that when there's so many changes you want to make, like which ones are you going to say no to? And how can you be more confident in the ones you're saying no to and choosing the right ones, even though you probably can never choose them all? But what's your process for choosing the best you can?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, for me, I like to look at past stories. And so whenever I get stuck at something, I constantly research, right? So for example, right, okay, one of my biggest issues right now is how do you run a sustainable media company? You know, how do you build a brand that lasts for a long time? And so the best ways to get answers is to look at the people that have done it already. And now you don't necessarily have to look at specific things and do specifically what they did, but like, let's put it this way, right? The road to success constantly sort of changes, right? But the philosophies are always, they're always still there. The messaging is always there, right? It's kind of like marketing in general, right? In marketing, there's mediums are constantly changing. How you market is constantly changing, right? But in terms of the messaging and everything, from point A to point B, it's the same. It's kind of like, how do I get you to buy this product? How do I get you to really, you know, understand this, right? And so when I'm thinking of decisions and everything, yes, there's so many different directions that you could definitely go to, right? And I think that how I kind of narrow it down is just, I think that I literally spent hours and hours researching. And this goes back to my curiosity of people too. I like understanding people. I like understanding everybody's story because like through those stories, I'm going to get these sort of nuggets that will kind of, you know, help me generally get to the direction I want, right? And you're completely right. I mean, my philosophy is always like, okay, well, I'd rather just, if something's not working, make a change of some sort, right? But there's so many directions you can go. And the way that I need to figure out is I still want to have relatively a good average, if that makes sense. I still want to have as much of a positive average as possible. And so I definitely think a lot nowadays before I make a move, I guess you could say. I'm definitely impatient though. I mean, when I say like, I'm not going to spend like days trying to make a decision. I'm probably going to make a decision like the same day. But before that, you're going to see me glued to the screen for the next like 8 to 12 hours, or maybe even completely overnight until And by morning, you know, I'll have an alarm clock set. It's like, okay, I got to make a decision now. This is what I think is the best way to go.
Great. So if we linger on that point, Benny, and the way that you, I guess, develop a deeper understanding of problems, and we focus now on building a sustainable media company, what have you learned?
Man, I think it's a good question, because we look at media in general, right? I mean, how many media companies are really truly doing well right now? You know, if you look at all the new media darlings, like let's say BuzzFeed or Vice, you know, these, they've raised like hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, they were going to become the next CNNs of the world or whatever it is. But really, I mean, the only ones that you are kind of seeing that are doing well, I mean, there's, let's say, small anomalies, right? Like let's say, you know, Axios. Axios has been doing an incredible job. I think that they just had a huge exit too. There's also brands like Morning Brew, right, that are more focused on newsletter business, right, that are kind of new age, that have had like, you know, good success or good exits, right? But again, these are very, very, you know, small amounts if you look at the entire industry, right? But really, the ones that are still kind of sustaining themselves okay are the legacy publications, like let's say, I don't know, like New York Times, right? Or maybe the Wall Street Journal. Or if you're a nonprofit, say, nonprofit legacy brand like the Associated Press of some sort, right? But these are still like legacy brands, right? I don't think anybody's really truly figured it out yet, you know, especially since like we're at a time where it seems like all the platforms dominate everything. I mean, I still remember life before the internet. And back then, we would still be entering, you know, certain websites that we like going to, right? Like if I want to read the news, okay, I read the New York Times. I'm going to type in the New York Times every morning, right? Nowadays, most young people, millennials, they get a lot of their news through social media. I mean, you know, in terms of the attention game, like all the major platforms have really kind of like dominated that. You know, Google kind of dominates search, Facebook kind of dominates like just like linking out to different, you know, places and everything. Instagram, they have their own thing too. TikTok, they have theirs. So, I mean, and I'd ask you guys too, when's the last time you typed in a URL to like, let's say a news source or really like any website? I mean, I would pin myself that there's probably maybe, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm gonna guess that maybe there's less than 10 URLs that you regularly type to a homepage right now. Correct me if I'm wrong, by the way.
No, probably. I'd say so. I don't think I type many homepages at all because all my tabs stay open. I don't shut down my computer, so everything's up anyway. But yeah, not really many. Henry, you?
I think my user journey often starts on Google. Even if I don't have any particular affiliation or desire to go to a specific media source. For example, like I don't go to the Washington Post to look up certain things. I literally usually just start at Google. But yeah, in terms of just typing the URL, it's always just the key players. You sort of, you know, Facebook, the Instagrams. Like I'll type INS or I'll type TWIT and then whatever would come up as a result. Yeah, but not many links specifically.
Yeah. It's like mostly, I mean, even for me, like most of my stuff is social media. If I'm not checking Google, I'm like you, Henry. I mean, I check Google a lot, but for the most part, I'm on social media platforms and, you know, or I'm checking my email, if anything.
Yeah, cool. So in terms of your, I guess, Forbes 30 Under 30 is obviously an amazing achievement. How did you come about that? What was it like to receive that? And yeah, I've never actually spoken to anyone who's received it before. So I'd love to hear what that process was like.
Yeah, that's an interesting journey as well. I mean, I think that I first came across the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, I think back in 2014. You might need to fact check this. I think it was either their first year that they launched it or second year that they launched it. But I remember, you know, seeing it and I saw like, you know, I think I saw like Mark Zuckerberg on it and all these like incredible, like, Evan, like, you know, I think the Instagram founders were also on it too and everything. And I was thinking, wow, this is so incredible to see these different leaders across all these different industries, you know, doing really well. And on top of that, I had read some stats as the years went on that it's harder to get into than all the Ivy Leagues or something like that, like harder to get into Harvard, you know, on the list than Harvard, Stanford, like statistically speaking, right? And I would say, I was like, man, it would be really, really cool to get on this list someday, you know, but at the time, I mean, I was still a brand new entrepreneur. I mean, a part of me still felt that was still really far from, I was still really far from that, you know? So I really didn't pay no mind to it. And then when I sold the company and then I started NextShark, I'll be like honest and say, I mean, I think for a good, like maybe 2 years, I was trying to like figure out ways to, you know, get on the list and everything. It's like, oh, like, okay, I need to get someone to nominate me and everything. And I remember trying for like, I think it was like at maybe like, you know, 2 years. I think, you know, could be three too. Like just trying, asking for, you know, nominations, like asking people to put in a good word for me and what have you. Because I was like, man, I really want to get on this list. It would be really cool to get on it. And then I turned 29. And I remember that was like the year where it was my last year to get it. And I kind of told myself, and at that point, I kind of had like, you know, a certain level of maturity now, and also like feeling a little bit jaded too, as well. And I was like, you know, I'm not even going to try. I mean, this is like my last year. I should just focus on my business, building a good product and go from there. I shouldn't be pursuing like vanity things like this. And it's just not healthy. And it's just not a good way to, you know, it deviates from what I am trying to do. And that's to build a sustainable business. And you know what's funny? Lo and behold, like it was like, I think this, you know, that summer, I still remember that day. I was vacationing in Japan with, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife. And I got an email from Forbes going, hey, I'm so-and-so from Forbes. We're part of the team that handles the 30 under 30 list every year. And you came really highly recommended this year. And, you know, I would like to, you know, could you answer these questions for me? And I'm like, really? That's crazy. I mean, like, I was like, I thought it was a joke for a second there. But even then, I wasn't really thinking about it as much. I was like, okay, cool. I'll submit my questions and everything. And then about like a month or two later, they had emailed me again just to clarify some things. I'm like, hey, we're kind of going to their final rounds. Could you like, you know, maybe provide us a little bit more info? And I'm like, okay, cool. I still didn't think of anything. And then literally 2 months later, I remember. It was funny. I think it was like a November 2017 or something. And then, you know, first thing I do every morning is I, you know, bad habit, I check my phone immediately and, you know, check my emails, right? And then I'm scrolling through and then I see this email from Forbes. I said, you've made the Forbes 30 under 30 list. Congratulations. And I'm like, wait, what? It was like a double take. Like I didn't even react until I actually clicked on the email and I read through it. And it was from Randall Lane, who I think he's higher up now on Forbes, but I believe he was the editor in chief of Forbes 30 under 30 at the time. And it was like a congratulation letter. And then I remember, and then I went to my text messages. I got like, I think it was like 30, you know, 35 messages or something like that. And I was like more than usual. And people were blowing up my phones. My social media was blowing up and everything. And suddenly like, you know, people were congratulating me everywhere. And like this, by the way, this happened all in the span of minutes. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then, so the first thing I did, I ran out the door and then I'm like, and then I, you know, I told my girlfriend, like, oh my God, I made the Forbes 30 under 30 list. Holy crap. And honestly, the rest was history from there. I mean, it was, honestly, I was in shock for like a good 3-4 days because I was like, I didn't even like think of, just imagine my shock because like, I technically already like, I've given up. I'm not paying. No mind to this. And, you know, suddenly, and, you know, kind of accepting that maybe it wasn't going to work out. And suddenly like you just somebody hands it to you, you know, I mean, of course, like didn't hand it to me, but you know, it just suddenly disappears. Right. And so you can imagine that feeling. And it's a feeling that it's something that you've wanted, but it's also not something you expected to at the same time. I mean, like it's those two feelings together. I mean, it was pretty crazy.
I'm going to ask you a question that, I don't know. It's a little bit less objective, I would say. In terms of that, when you were kind of really wanting it, you were doing all the things to kind of get onto the list. And then when you kind of let go and then you kind of, I don't know, someone might say you left it up to the universe. So you let it go so you weren't strangling it and it had a way to find itself, it found a way to you. Do you believe in that kind of thing? And would you think that that is something that does happen when sometimes it's in your focus and you're holding on too tight and you're putting too much energy into it. And then sometimes when you just let it go, then sometimes it does come to you. Do you believe that?
You know, it's interesting. I ask myself that a lot too. Before I was such a crazy realist. It's kind of like you get what you get and you know, what have you, right? I think as you get older, you become more spiritual. And I think that my way of thinking is that I do think you can manifest a lot of things from within, for sure. But I also think it kind of goes hand in hand. I mean, if something is on your mind, all the time. And I'm a huge believer in small actions, even the smallest actions, because if you think about it, like the smallest micro actions, if you have enough of them, could have big lasting impacts, you know what I mean? And so whether you're spiritual or not, and I also think it's a different way of looking at it too. I mean, you can look at it from a spiritual point of view, right? Or you can look at it from an aspect of, I have this on my mind, like kind of 24/7, right? If you go to back to sports, right? Michael Jordan, he was crazy. You know, you think that, oh, like, you know, Kobe Bryant or Jordan, these guys like totally, they were born for it or whatever. But then you got to look at how hard they worked too. I mean, they were there at the gym before anybody else. Tony Gunawan was at the gym before anybody else. They put in those hours. Basketball, badminton, it was on their minds 24/7. It became like, it's like Tony says, it's in his blood. Badminton is in his blood, right? I mean, how can't you not be successful at some point if you keep, you know, if you continue with that sort of mindset too, you know? And now once you get it, right, that's up to you to how you want to interpret it. Like, was it because like, oh, it's something that I just completely focused on, I prayed for it, or I kept going and this is how it is, or it's like, this was my journey. I think every journey is just up for interpretation and everybody interprets their journey differently.
Yeah. I mean, it's like they're, speaking of that, I guess the Jordans and the Gunawans and the Bryants of the world, it's like their advantage was gained when everyone was falling, was asleep, basically. They were just working so much harder and obviously more strategically too, a lot of the time. So if we think about, well, if we switch from talking about going from being the Forbes 30 under 30, yeah, being on that list, and then we look at this message that you sent, you had with Jeff before this podcast, and I'll read this out to you because you said it, it's your words, people are never doing as well as you think. And I just want to, I guess, explore that a bit with you in terms of, yeah, what are your thoughts on this? And yeah, why do you think that it is so important to everyone that they are seen as successful, or, you know, it's successful in their own terms, right? But why do you think that's important? And what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I think I could angle this in many different ways, right? We can talk about, let's say, current events, right? We're kind of in this age of social media where before it was like authentic content. Now it's kind of like, what are the best highlights? You know, these are the highlights of my life and I only post the highlights of my life, right? But then we can go even deeper than this, right? I mean, if let's say we're bumping into each other and I don't know how, let's say, you know, you and me, Jeff, or you and me, Henry, right? We don't know each other that well. Maybe like, you know, if we bump each other in the street, we'll greet each other. And then the first question we ask each other is, how are you, right? And most of the time that question, oh, I'm fine, I'm good. But are you really good? We say that maybe as like an off the cuff thing. That's kind of what we're trained to do. And it's also maybe it's a courtesy sort of thing too, where it's like, hey, I don't want to bombard you with all the crap in my life that's happening right now. And so that's a point that I want to get across too, because it's not so much about like, because I feel that, you know, people could look at it negatively where it's like, oh, people just want to show the best parts of themselves and that's about it. Sometimes it's not so much about that like, oh, I'm trying to hide the things. You know, so other times it's like, I don't want to burden you guys with all the crap that I'm doing. Like, what if like my feed was just like me talking about like all these different parts of my life that keep bothering me and everything, right? Or maybe we're not even there yet on a personal level too, right? So I think for me, it's that the messaging that I want to give out to that is that it's really easy to, you know, kind of compare yourself to others, right? To see someone's highlight reel, right? Or to look at somebody and meet them and be like, wow, this guy's really successful. But chances are, they're dealing with their own demons. They're dealing with their own issues in life. I mean, everybody has challenges. I firmly believe that life is fair in various ways. And I think everyone has like some sort of major challenge that they're sort of dealing with, right? And I don't think they need to really hide those. I don't think most people, you know, really are trying to hide it. It's just more like a personal thing where it's like, I don't know if it's socially appropriate. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I actually really like your take on it, Benny, because I think maybe that's the pessimist or realist in me, maybe more pessimist than anything, in that when I often see lots of people posting their highlights on social media, it's like, is that what you want to portray? Like, is that all you're doing, just showing everyone your highlights? But when you say that perhaps it's not that they're just trying to show off, or it's not just signaling and as a vanity kind of metric. It's just that they don't want to burden everyone else with the other side, those demons that you're talking about. So I really like that perspective that you shared.
Well, one thing to also note too, you talked about something, the pessimist side of you, right? One of the notions that I find, and this is something that I've learned recently too, in the, maybe the last year or so. My friend, he's a big fan of this guy named Dr. DeMartini. I think he's like a high level like coach of some sort. I don't know too much about him, but like, you know, I learned it from this friend of mine where, and he said something where, you know, when he took like a couple lessons from him and, you know, went through his course and everything, what was interesting was that oftentimes when you think of, when you, let's say you get a big high point, right? Let's say like, okay, let's say you just won the lottery of some sort. That's a high point. Oftentimes, like you only think of only the positives and everything. And so the notion that he brings to the table is you need to balance yourself, you know, on the scale, no matter like where you go. So for example, like if you're feeling like, you know, way too high up here, find some ways to bring yourself down. And if you're feeling way too low on a huge low point, find some ways to bring yourself up. And specifically what I mean by that is, okay, let's just say in this scenario, you won the lottery, right? So good feelings all around, you're rich or whatever it is. But most people don't think about the negatives. So what if I said, okay, you already know all the positives in your head because that's all you're thinking right now. Why don't you take out a piece of paper and write down all the negatives, right? Maybe it's like, oh, now like I have to get a money manager because like, you know, I need to figure out how much I owe in taxes, right? Number two, now that people know who I am or family members know I'm wealthy, like are people going to start hounding me for money? I'm going to get more attention. I don't know whether people are just going to want to meet me for me or they want me kind of for my money of some sort, right? And this is not so much about like being ungrateful per se. This is more so just like kind of centering yourself just a little bit, right? And this relates to everything. Even if like, let's say I won the world championship in badminton or whatever it is, right? That's a high point. That's a great moment that should be celebrated. But at the same time, you got to look at it. Okay, so what are some negatives? Okay, well, maybe I'm going to be super famous now and I'm not going to be able to spend as much, you know, I don't know, alone time or whatever it is, right? Or secondly, wow, now like I'm going to have to work extra hard to keep this, you know, sort of to keep up here because like now like the target's on my back now. Like everybody wants to beat the champion, right? And so in the end, I think that that kind of helps, that way of centering yourself, I think that really kind of helps you as you continue on your journey too.
Yeah, that's cool. I do know DeMartini and I've done like quite a few Tony Robbins things as well. And I think he frames them in a bit of a different way. He calls it kind of your emotional home. And he talks about, yeah, sometimes you can be really high and then sometimes you can be really low in comparison to your home or what your kind of default emotion is. And it's just trying to make sure that you return to home as best as you can, because it's difficult to maintain the emotions that are too far away from this emotional home. So I think it sounds like a similar kind of take to that. Nice. Okay. So Benny, obviously you are very successful. You've Forbes 30 under 30, you've done heaps. And I know that we've said that many times, so hopefully that's okay. But in terms of success, like we're looking out, we don't know you that well. It'd be awesome to continue to chat offline at any stage, but obviously from what you've done, you've had a media company that's been acquired. You've got a new media company. You've got many things that you're doing. You've got Shuttler 16. And I think Henry said that you have some other projects going on because he was doing some stalking of you as well. And then you work with the high-end chefs, et cetera. So from an outside view, it does look like you're doing really well and everyone would define you as very successful. But I'd love to hear from you, what does success mean to you personally?
That's a good question as well. When I was younger, success was like that. What's that dollar amount that you want? You know, it was a money thing. Nowadays, it's like success really just, honestly, for me, like, and I don't mean to be cheesy and everything, but like, okay, let's just say before I became a parent, right? Before I became a parent, success would be, you know, creating something that is sustainable and good for the community. You know, for me, making money is not really kind of like a driving force for me. And that's not coming from someone that's wealthy. Like I'm not a wealthy guy. I have a lot of projects and everything, but money doesn't really interest me, you know, that much. Like I like to build, I like to, you know, work on the ground in the trenches with my team members and everything. I don't like to forget where I came from. I really do like enjoy working and all that good stuff. So yeah, I mean, back before becoming a dad, really, it was that, like building something that could be a positive impact to the community. And not try to, you know, really capitalize it as much. Nowadays, like, you know, since I'm a new dad and, you know, I have a 1-year-and-8-month-old at home, success to me is really just hoping that I can do something that makes him proud of me, to be honest. I mean, just raising this kid right And, you know, and for me, like why that's become kind of like a big priority for me is that I'm helping raise the next generation. And, you know, for me and as citizens of this world, I think that the best thing that we could do for the next generation is to leave them better than we found them, prepare them to make the world a better place. Of course, we need to make our own contributions to make a good world, but we also really need to teach the next generation the right things too. And I think that that's much more important than anything that you can do in this lifetime. And I don't mean this from a perspective of like, just being a parent, you can do this. I mean, like there's teachers out there. I mean, even like as badminton coaches and everything, like we're trained, like that sort of job is, it's incredibly important because like even something as like maybe simple as badminton, right? A badminton coach, you actually have a big impact on these juniors that you're working with because like no matter the lessons that you impart in them in badminton, like that's going to become their inner voice with other things that they do in life. Whether it's in business, socializing, work, whatever that may be, you know? And so I always give props to anybody that is in a line of work that works with, you know, young people and it's helping, you know, build their mindset and help grow them for the future.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I guess, yeah, when we're talking about coaching and badminton specifically, obviously you didn't have the typical badminton development that most players would get these days, but yeah, being able to coach and help support kids on their development in as part of any journey is fantastic to be involved with, to have that contribution as well. So Benny, we are wrapping up now. Do want to finish with one last question, and this is off the cuff because it wasn't scripted. So if you were to leave the world today, what would be the one message that you would give before you go?
Ooh, that's a very good question.
Where did this come from?
Yeah,
I don't know. I just thought I'd throw one in just off script.
You only live once. Make the best of it. That's kind of like my off the cuff like answer. Yeah, if I had to like answer within like 5 seconds.
Nice. It is true. Okay, Benny, so it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. For those listeners who are listening in their car or can't see the screen, we'd love for you to shout out any of the projects you're working with, the Instagram handles, the websites, anything that you might want to let the listeners know, as in how you're doing, follow what you're up to, but also follow what NextShark and all the other projects you're doing. You don't have to name all of them, and you can send them through to us and we can put them in the podcast description. But just for those who are listening, we'd love for you to shout those out.
For me, yeah, I'm not good at self-promotion really, but I would say that if you want to follow me, I am at Benny Liu, BENNYLUO on most social media platforms. If you want to follow NextShark, my media company, which is what I'm known for, it's pretty much at NextShark on everything. I also have, I'm a partner at a seafood market that I'm really proud of in LA. And that handle is just at Joint Seafood.
Awesome. So we'll put those in the podcast description. So you make sure you do check them out. Benny, again, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much from myself, Henry, and all the listeners for coming on to this episode of the Badminton Podcast.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks, Benny.
Thanks, Benny.
So from Henry and I at the Badminton Podcast, thanks for tuning in to this episode. If you've enjoyed it or found it useful, be sure to share it with your family, friends, teammates, and someone outside your badminton circle too, because with your help, we can show the world how incredible badminton is.
To keep up to date with new episodes and who we're interviewing next, make sure you connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn at The Badminton Podcast, and on Twitter at The Badminton Pod. Feel free to contact us and ask any questions, give us feedback, or request topics for future episodes. We love hearing from you. And remember to check out and shop for your simple and minimalist badminton gear at volantwear.com. Catch you on the next episode.
Bye.